Welcome back, everybody. Everybody streaming and catching us. We are also available on Zoom. I will share the link in the Instagram chat. I have a very interesting format and discussion for us today. One of my earlier guests, Anna, is actually going to be, you know, mostly hosting, and I will be in more of a supportive role. Think of me as tech support. You know, when things stop working, I'll tell you to reboot. That's my role today. So Anna's going to be coming in, and we've got Dr. Imad, who's, you know, graciously, you know, is giving us time today to answer a lot of questions that you guys might have, you know, pertaining to ADHD. So without holding you guys back, Anna, please go ahead.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you, Ali and Mental Health AE for having us and hosting this event. Your efforts in the community are really are very much appreciated. You're spreading a lot of awareness about mental health. My name is Anna Kaminski. I'm an ADHD coach based in Abu Dhabi, and I work with families and adults. And we are absolutely delighted to have Dr. Imad with us today. Dr. Imad Farag is a consultant at the American Center for Psychiatry and Neurology in Abu Dhabi. He works with children and adolescents, but he's also a clinical lead of adult ADHD service at the American Center. Dr. Imad also serves as an executive board member of the United Kingdom ADHD Partnership, in short, UKAP, and is also a member of the training subcommittee. Thank you, Dr. Imad, for offering your time and expertise to us tonight. It is very, very much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
I'd love you to have you. I don't want to take time from you, so I would really love you to start telling us maybe first what ADHD is.
Okay, ADHD is, primarily, it is a neurodevelopmental disorder, which means you are typically born with it, and it is a genetic disorder, runs in families, quite highly hereditable, about 80%. So you're 8 times more likely to have a parent or a first degree relative who has ADHD as well, looking around. The primary symptoms of ADHD or the presentations are broken down into 3 aspects. There is the inattention, which is the lack of ability to focus for long periods of time and easily distracted. The second part is hyperactivity, or what we would call fidgetiness, or as you get older, this hyperactivity is then more experienced rather than moving around a lot. It's much more a feeling of restlessness. And finally, there is what we call the impulsive tendencies. And these are in children, are very different to what you see in adults. So the children would be very much about doing things again and again without making any conscious decisions or weighing up the thoughts and getting into a lot of trouble for it or having difficulties because of it. But in adults, what you see is different impulsive behaviors that are more adult. Impulsive decisions in relationships, jumping from job to job. Those are the 3 main aspects of ADHD.
Anna, I think you're mute.
I was muted, sorry, because my cat was meowing.
I'm brilliant tech support.
Thank you. In many ways. Thank you for that, Dr. Imad. We have had a number of questions submitted prior to this meeting, and I will be asking those. We will also be reading those of the chat here, as well as the Instagram feed. Can you tell us how a parent of a child or teen knows that it's time to take them for an ADHD diagnosis or assessment or screening of some sort?
Okay, look, I think with anything, we have to be realistic in what we're defining as a disorder. So when you add the word disorder onto anything, it means it actually brings disorder or disruption to your daily functioning or day-to-day ability to function in a normal manner. So we all have problems focusing. From time to time, we all have problems with being fidgety. We all have problems with sometimes making ridiculous or impulsive decisions. But the question is this over and above what is normal for a normal person? So the same would go, for example, a person who has anxiety. We all are anxious. It's a kind of basic survival mode to be anxious. Otherwise, you would see a lion and say, hello, lion, and be eaten. But it's a survival mode. But the problem is when anxiety becomes disabling, when it doesn't allow you to do the things that you are supposed to be doing in a day-to-day life without struggling. Hence, the same would go with regards to ADHD. So when we're looking at these three aspects of difficulty focusing, is it over and above the level that is actually impacting on your daily functioning? So in a child, it would be, is he able to get his work done? Is he forgetting his things all over the place? Is he losing his things all the time to a point that it's causing disruption? And the same would go for hyperactivity or impulsivity. So really the aspect is, how much is this impacting on the person themselves and their day-to-day function, and as well as context. So if you have a child in school, the likelihood is you'll pick these things up much sooner because they are actual rules that need to be abided by. If you have a child who is working on a farm, the likelihood is you won't pick these things up very easily because the need for abiding or focus and attention to the degree that's needed in an educational setting is quite different.
Mm. Someone asked, and it is a question that is often asked, and it's an area that people are confused about. My daughter's teachers never complain about her. Can she have ADHD?
Okay, can I, first I'd like to highlight one thing. The word, or the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a broad term, okay? So that means there are three major subtypes for ADHD. The first is the combined subtype, where you have inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity, all of which are above a threshold that need to be managed. The other two are what you call ADD, where you don't have the hyperactive impulsive part. And it's the problem is mainly with the focus and attention. And that's why you hear ADHD, ADD. But you have a third one, which is ADHD, predominantly hyperactive impulsive. So you have no problem with focus, but you are constantly on the go, moving, impulsive, and the difficulties come from that, not with the difficult focus. So to kind of come, just there's a reason I'm saying this, is in most of the time, the predominant or the prevalence in boys is usually higher than girls. And that's not because they're actually different in prevalence. It's because they're picked up easier in boys, because boys tend to have the hyperactive impulsive streak more, which is likely to be causing problems in any setting more than just being inattentive. Females are more likely to have inattentive subtype, which really, when you have a girl in the classroom sitting at the back, not causing any problems and daydreaming, the likelihood is you're going to miss this girl and pick her up much later in her school time, when the bar of requirement to focus raises rather than earlier on. So the answer is yes, she may have ADHD, but the reason that she's not being picked up is probably because she's not causing any trouble.
Mm-hmm. Someone else asks, during puberty, do ADHD symptoms get worse, better, or stay the same?
Okay. I think puberty in itself is a very challenging time for all teenagers. One, from a perspective of the hormonal changes, the difficulties with finding themselves or becoming much more boundaried and wanting that kind of anonymity, independence, that kind of stepping back and wanting to be me. So the question here is, you know, does it affect ADHD in itself? The answer is, I don't think so. I think it's the added changes to a personality and the development of that personality that can become more, seem to make the age.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of development of ADHD throughout lifespan, what can be expected as we become adults? What happens to the symptoms?
So when you, of course, we have to be in broad terms. If it depends on the severity of your ADHD symptoms and what kind of combination you have. But in broad terms, the likelihood if you have ADHD as a child, so we'll take, for example, ADHD as the combined subtype, which is the most common one we see. the likelihood is that by the ages of 16 to 18, you have a 40% to 50% chance that all of a sudden all of this disappears. And we have no idea why. That's why sometimes they say, oh, well, he'll grow out of it. You know, he was a naughty kid and he grew out of it and he's matured. That's, you know, those are the lucky ones in a sense. But I think most people, if they do carry on into adulthood, the hyperactivity and impulsivity reduce to a degree that is manageable sometimes. The hyperactivity becomes more restlessness rather than actually physical hyperactivity. But the main problem that persists is the inattention. And you have to consider this as becoming a more of a problem because as you get older, the need to attend to things becomes more and more important, be it in a job, be it in whatever, family, relationships, the gap starts to really, really increase because you become fully independent. So what you have is difficulties with the attention that become the mainstay.
Would it be fair to say that it might be more difficult to diagnose ADHD in adults?
It would be it depends on what hat you have on, to be honest with you. So I in my experience, a lot of these patients are diagnosed in retrospect because what tends to happen is now when you are struggling all of your life with focus, attention, behavior, and you're always in trouble, what tends to happen is you're always told off or you're always being criticized either by parents or by teachers or by friends even. And you become, it impacts on your self-esteem, it impacts on developing anxiety and depression. And we know that people who are not treated earlier on have a higher prevalence of anxiety and depression in adult life. Now, what tends to happen is if you haven't picked up the ADHD is you usually would go to see a psychiatrist for depression or anxiety. And they tend to start treating the anxiety and depression because, you know, they don't have the experience in looking back into, you know, the developmental history as well. And what happens is it's very difficult that what you see is the treatment resistant depression or anxiety because the root cause isn't being addressed. So what happens is when they, you know, when it's highlighted at some point where they think, ah, maybe, and they come to an adult ADHD service or someone who has experience with adult ADHD, it's the rewind. You kind of take them back a bit and you realize actually this is ADHD and the anxiety or depression is a comorbid disorder that has developed over time as a result. So when you then treat the ADHD, what you find is the anxiety and depression starts to alleviate itself.
So does it mean that whether children, teenagers, or adults, when they approach specialists, like those are certainly people that I see a lot of, they approach various specialists for help, and the help is not effective. They don't feel that the problems are alleviated. Would it be a good enough reason to dig deeper and maybe approach an ADHD specialist for ADHD assessment?
I always say that if something isn't working, you have to do the first thing that is the right thing to do is question your diagnosis. It's the only decent, correct thing to do. There is no ego in a patient-doctor relationship. There is what is right for this patient of mine or my client. We in psychiatry, we base our decisions on the best information available to us at a given point in time. And it is our duty then to review that given new information that comes to light or possible new avenues to go down. And yes, review it. So I would say if something isn't working, question it.
Mm-hmm. So what specialists would you advise people to approach? It might be different for children and adolescents and adults. If they suspect the child or the person, the adult might have ADHD, who do they go to, especially in the Middle East?
Well, Google usually is the one they go to first, in my experience. But
I mean the type of specialist, psychologist.
I would probably say a psychiatrist or a psychologist, those are the best two, logically speaking. If there is a service that provides specialties, particularly with regards to neurodevelopmental disorders such as ADHD, or someone with an understanding of that background, then I would definitely kind of go down that that line. But yes, psychology or psychiatry are the first two lines to go down.
Mm-hmm. And what can people expect? Because sometimes people ask about assessments, and they often mean a battery of tests that as a result will let them know whether they have ADHD or not. Mm-hmm. Or some people even have been advised to have brain scans. And one of the questions was about that. I certainly have heard that from a few clients, that in some parts of the world, especially, brain scans are done to diagnose ADHD. How is ADHD diagnosed?
Okay. I'm very, very passionate about this question in particular, because what I have to say is like I said, we are based on information, and there is no one test that will actually give you an answer to making a diagnosis. So it's kind of like being in court. That's why you're called a consultant. You kind of hear the defense, you hear the prosecution, you listen to the witnesses, you ask for forensic evidence, and you take that all away, and then you come to a decision, okay? And the same goes for any diagnostic process. So things like, for example, you will see a doctor or a psychologist, you will have a history taken, you will have informant information from parents, a developmental history taken, you'll get information from schools, you will also use what we call screening tools. And this is something really I find a bit maybe skewed, is screening tools are exactly what they say they are. They are supportive evidence. So if you score on a screening tool, it doesn't mean you have ADHD. It means you have issues with focus, attention, hyperactivity. But there are other reasons that may be causing these. So that's why, and things like, for example, a TOVA test, which is a computer-based test for attention. Again, it only gives you information about focus. It doesn't give you diagnosis. Diagnosis is based on criteria. And all of these things have to be taken into account to come to this outcome. So no test, no questionnaire, independently will do that. Now, scans, brain scans, the answer is no, quite flat out no. There is no reason for me to put someone under a radiation or expose them to any of this for no particular reason. The changes in the brain are not diagnostic, they are associative. So whatever you see, and it would have to be functional MRI, which is extremely costly and extremely invasive if you're going to have to inject someone with some sort of radioactive material, not with much evidence. So it's much more research-based to look at associations. Diagnostic, I would not advise it at all.
Thank you. Now, you're a doctor, so many people will probably imagine that they go to you and they will have to take medication. Can you tell us a little bit more about treating ADHD, and that includes medication for ADHD?
Sure. So again, I would look at it from what we call in the UK, the NICE guidelines, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And the evidence-based approach is, if it is a mild to moderate ADHD, the advice is that you use conservative behavioral methods. So for example, in younger people, it would be behavioral approaches and parenting. And now, please don't take this the wrong way. This is not because it's bad parenting. It's more to know more about the ADHD and enable the parent to manage these behaviors in a particular way. Okay, so, you know, a lot of the times they say, oh, you know, well, you're not parenting right, that's why he's behaving like this. No, it's got nothing to do with your parenting. This is a genetic inherited neurodevelopmental disorder. Okay, it's not the parenting that has caused this. There are difficulties in parenting when it comes to ADHD, because let's be honest, it's extremely frustrating. And, you know, it'll push any parent to the edge, and it might cause some very negative dynamic within the family and cause a lot of family discord. And in turn, the relationship between both the patient and the parent or vice versa can be, I mean, imagine if your mom or dad are constantly saying, oh, did you do this? Oh, you forgot. Why didn't you do that? No, not again. Oh, that, what happens is this child starts to kind of close down. And they don't want to do anything, or they'll say, oh, I forgot, or they'll shrug their shoulders. And this closing down, people see as oppositional behavior. It's actually protective behavior to a large degree, because it kind of goes from I can't do it to I won't do it, because I don't want to be seen unable. Now, going back to the question, as you see, I can digress a bit. So mild to moderate, it'd be very much conservative approaches and not medication-based. Depending on the impairment, and this is the key question, you would recommend medication and psychological input. So ideally both. Now, of course, at the end of the day, what we can do is provide the evidence and give you the information. There is no, you know, you don't force anyone into treatment. It's a matter of informed decision. I know there's a lot of myths about medications. There's a lot of stories that people read about or hear about. And I think the only logical thing to do is for us as doctors who are responsible for this medication is to provide the best, informed decision-making session, even if it's a full session with the parents and the child, if they're of an age where they can understand exactly what's expected and how it works, and ask questions. I usually ask my patients, we sit down, we discuss it, we go through it, and then I give them information leaflets. And even if they've made a decision to take the medication, I usually would ask them to go away and come back in a week and do some Googling or research and write down the questions they have, whatever they may be, so that when you're actually going to try medication, you're owning this decision. You know exactly what you're expecting. You know everything. It's not like here's a pill. That doesn't work.
Thank you. And I want to come back to parenting. I've got a lot of questions about behavior and parenting, as you can imagine. But I would like to stick with medication for one more moment, because like you said, there are many myths and much misinformation about medication. Can you tell us whether medication for ADHD is safe, whether it's addictive, whether we have to take it for the rest of our lives? What's the deal?
Okay, so let's start with, is it safe? Yes, very safe if given in the right manner. And also if there are no underlying contraindications for giving that medication. And there are very few, but that's why it's important to have what we call a baseline health check before we kind of step into taking medications. And of course, depending on whether you're going for a stimulant or a non-stimulant medication, then you would have different kind of indications and contraindications. But from a safety perspective, they're very safe if correctly given. Now, the other big question is it addictive? Okay, because people hear stimulant and they think, okay, is it an amphetamine? Now, they are safe and they are not addictive, again, if used in a therapeutic manner. Of course, any drug, when you look at it, can be diverted into abuse. Okay? But the abuse potential of this drug is very low, extremely low. I've known adults, for example, who've gone down the self-medication route and abused illicit substances because they're treating their ADHD. And when you actually give them the medication, what happens is they have no more cravings for the substances and they stop the medication, the substances. So no, they are not addicted if used correctly. Mm-hmm. And will, as part of your question, will they be needed for the rest of their lives? Depending, again, this all depends on the severity of your ADHD. So, for example, if you have a mild to moderate ADHD and you've chosen to use medication as part of your treatment, what tends to happen is now you have the ability to focus a bit more. You get yourself with, say, coaching or therapy as well. You start to build the framework and the points of reference and routines and habits. With time, you couldn't do that before because you simply didn't have the focus or attention to do that. But now with the medication, for example, and with coaching and with a framework and therapy, you start to develop these as second nature. So the likelihood of you needing the medication as frequently becomes less and less, depending on the severity of the condition. So I'll give you a small example. How many of us stand at the door and do three things? Keys, wallet, and, we've done that and it's become a habit because quite simply keys, wallet, phone, exactly. And sometimes, I've done it before because, I'm forgetful, but I've keys, wallet, phone, and I've left the house and it's actually a coffee cup in my hand instead of the keys and I've locked myself out. So it can be, once you get into habits of doing things, you will start to rely less and less. But what enables you to be able to do those habits is sometimes using the medication for periods of time.
Right. And you answered my next question a little bit, because many people are asking about managing ADHD without medication. So we now know that it's possible. You said if it's mild or moderate, it's possible to manage without medication. Can you tell us more about what else can people do, whether for children, teens, or adults, if they choose not to take medication? How can they manage ADHD?
Okay. Now, being real, if we are talking mild or mild to moderate, that is when the likelihood of any other therapeutic intervention would be likely to help. It's really unlikely if you have moderate to severe ADHD that there's going to be much success in other modalities. So if we're talking mild to moderate, then the things that I would look at is coaching, life coaching, believe it or not. I would also look at therapy. So there is cognitive behavioral therapy specifically for ADHD. These are things, depending on the age, of course, but these are things that look at different aspects of ADHD. So for example, time management, procrastination, worrying, different aspects of ADHD organization. And they work on a specific program, which is called. Those are the two things. Now, there are other things that work for some, depending. Things like meditation, yoga, mindfulness. The big one, especially if there's hyperactivity involved, is sports. I would get your child into sports, an adolescent into sports.
I'm just reading through the question. Thank you for that. Through the questions that were submitted in the chat. And I'm trying to stay on topic and sort of have a flow in terms of a topic of conversation, but we might have to just jump around a bit. Marilena asks, this is great to be informed about the brain scan. So many doctors prescribe scans. Does food have an effect on it, on ADHD, I assume?
Okay, so this is the famous E-colors or E-chemicals. As the sweets and artificial colorings have an impact on. I would say, realistically, not that much. Sugars generally can cause hyperactivity or excitement. E-colors as well in high concentrations or kind of more chronic use of the artificial colorings in foods, they would, but not in yes, in the longer term, yes, they may increase the hyperactivity, but they don't cause. So yes, for example, you wouldn't give a child who is hyperactive, you would try to reduce the sugar intake to help, but it will not actually treat or cause. And another one that I could mention here is there's a lot about omega oils or fish oils with regards to ADHD treatment. That is true, but you have to read the small prints of papers. So you will need a huge amount of omega oils on a daily basis to give you the impact that you will need. Now, omega oils given with medication in the long run allow for the reduced dose of medication. So if you were taking, say, for example, Ritalin 20 milligrams a day, then if you're taking it with omega-3 oils or fish oils, in the long term, you may not need the 20 milligrams, you may need 10. But it increases the efficacy, in a sense, or allows for a reduced dose, but independently will not actually treat the ADHD symptoms.
Okay. So I want to ask about the age of assessment. From what is the minimal age?
Okay. Reasonably speaking, I would say from the age of 4 onwards. Treatment-wise, I mean, we have to take into account the context of the child and their development, because development is slightly different from person to person. You wouldn't expect, it's not linear. So you'd have to take it in that context. I would probably say that the reasonable time is the age of 5 onwards, because that's when you can actually start, if you were to treat medically there with medication, you can actually license medications from 5 on.
Mm-hmm.
Before that.
Okay, so maybe you could answer another question on this topic. What is the medication that's prescribed for children and what are the side effects?
Okay, so we have the evidence-based medications. First-line treatments are stimulants and non-stimulants. So a stimulant, I mean, this maybe the semantics are quite different, but you could ask, why do you give someone who's already hyperactive a stimulant? Because then you're just going to make them more hyperactive. They do not stimulate movement. They stimulate the production or the increased secretion of dopamine in what we call the prefrontal cortex, where we are lacking dopamine in patients with ADHD. And they then allow to plug into the postsynaptic receptors, which regulates those behaviors. So it increases the stimulates the secretion of dopamine in that area. So stimulants are what we call either long-acting or short-acting. So medications that are short, so you have two stimulants. It's either methylphenidate, which is one salt, or it's dexamphetamine, which is another salt. So the methylphenidate is Ritalin, which is the short acting, usually works within 15 minutes, works for a maximum of 4 hours, and usually those are ones that you give twice or three times a day. And then you have the longer acting methylphenidate, which usually have an XL on the end, and that's not extra large, it's extended release. And they tend to work for 8 to 10 hours, 12 in some people. And it's simply the same chemical, methylphenidate, but they are made, or the tablet is engineered in a way that actually it dissolves and releases a bit every now and then, so that it gives you extended release. And the same applies for dexamphetamine, which most of you would know as Adderall. And the same goes for Adderall XR, which is a other group is called non-stimulants, and they came across this by mistake, believe it or not. They were testing a medication, which is an SSRI, which we use for anxiety and depression in children. And they found that the cohort of children with ADHD got much, much better. So they actually then changed the marketing for Atomol. Finding medications in the mental health world, you stumble across them by mistake. Those are the two medications. Side effect-wise, stimulants have certain side effects, such as most prominently is appetite suppression. So you always want to make sure that your child is eating before and between doses if you're dosing more than once. You also want to make sure that you're always having his weight taken. So we have a baseline before medication of weight, height, blood pressure, and pulse, because you want to make sure that the effects of medication on these things are not negative. So if I have a child, say, for example, he weighs 30 kilograms and I give him some Ritalin or stimulant, and the next time I see him, he weighs 23 kilograms, then, the next time I see him, he's 20 kilograms, I need to consider changing or stopping his medication, even if he's benefiting from, because his physical safety or physical health is as important. So we might change to a non-stimulant medication. Pulse and blood pressure might slightly go up, but these are transient because it's a stimulant, and within a certain range is safe. And that's why we measure every time they come in. And of course, the appetite and maybe slightly affected in non-stimulants, and headaches are common in non-stimulants SSRIs. Now, there are a list, let me be very clear so it's not clear. There is a long list of side effects. And I think the important thing is to remember that there are common side effects. And when we say common in medicine, we don't mean more than 50%. It means 1 in 10. Okay, that's common. And then there are less common and rare and extremely rare. And, for medical legal reasons, you'll have to kind of go through the pamphlet itself. And there's a reason they stick them into this tiny microscopic piece of paper. So that, if you read a Panadol's leaflet, you'll worry. And I guess it's important to ask these questions and important to be very clear with your doctor about them and get the answers that you need.
What kind of improvement can people expect from medication? So someone is asking, like to ask, what does the medication achieve? The person is talking about hyperactive. He used to move all the time, and now he is not. But his concentration span, attention span, is still the same. So yeah.
No, I don't understand if his movement issue was solved because of medicine or because he grows up. Okay. He has learning disabilities on the spectrum. Okay. So. Again, here's a little kind of caveat to all of this. There are certain comorbidities that make diagnosing ADHD a bit more tricky. So being on the spectrum is one of them, because there are certain things that you see on the spectrum that can actually look like ADHD, but are not ADHD. So for example, the constant movement with someone on the spectrum may be a sensory aspect of autism spectrum disorder rather than hyperactivity. It might be actually serving as a sensory relief for him, such as the pacing, the flapping, the movement. These are things that you see normally in childhood autism, or you may see activity, then you're going to be looking at it as ADHD. Now, that doesn't mean that autistic or learning disabled children or difficulties do not present with ADHD as well, but you really have to tease out what is what, because people on the spectrum and people with learning difficulties are much more sensitive to psychotropic medications than the neurotypical. You have to be very careful in dosing, you have to be very careful in how you introduce it and the effects of these medications. What you want with an ADHD medication is exactly what it says on the tin. You want improvement in focus and attention to a degree that's functional, hyperactivity to reduce, and impulsivity to reduce. Okay. What you don't want is sedating a person. That's not treating it. That's not treating the child. That's treating people around them because they don't want to deal with the difficulties. So I see sometimes parents. Sometimes I say, well, you just give him something because it's very difficult. You just need him to calm down. No, because the context here is not to sedate a child or not to, you know, now it is much more, am I giving the medication for the right reasons?
So you can expect the symptoms to become less bothersome, but you shouldn't see changes in personality, in the way that the person acts as they go about the day, because that this is something that is a concern for many people, that it's going to change the way they are as a person.
Now, they may, if your child is quite a bubbly and active child, and you see this quite a lot in adolescents, you hear the feedback from them saying that, you know, I take the medication and I focus much better, I'm doing much better at school and I'm not getting into much more trouble, but I just don't feel me. I feel like I'm boring, okay? And that's true, because the fact is that kind of off the cuff, you know, say bubbliness or impulsivity that has maybe defined him as a person has kind of been reduced. And he's focusing more, he's actually focusing more on what should be done. And he feels like I've become boring, and people are saying, are you okay? You're not talking as much. So yes, that feedback comes back, but it's a weighted risk benefit. This is what you have to say. I'm getting more out of the medication than actually the other way around. Mm. So no, it's not supposed to make you sit back and change as a person, but it's supposed to function for you in a positive manner.
Mm. Thank you. There are many questions about behavior, and some of them are here to do with ODD, and some of them were pre-submitted on the same topic. So can you tell us a bit more about oppositional defiant disorder, which is frequently seen with ADHD? Someone asked whether it's a part of ADHD, and then other behavioral issues that you can see in people with ADHD.
I think, oppositional defiant disorder, it's very commonly seen with ADHD, and it's kind of, you could say it's a tag, particularly in the older children who don't get diagnosed earlier on, and parents are kind of bringing them in, pulling their hair out, and saying, look, I tell them to go right, they go left, I tell them to do this, they do that, and they're just being really oppositional. So it's much more of a behavioral aspect. And I think it depends on what lens you look through. Parent, you will see it as being oppositional. As a child, like I said earlier, it could very much be the fact that they are just simply trying to avoid having to do anything that they will probably be told off for because they're not going to succeed in doing it because of the difficulties they have in focusing on hyperactivity or impulsivity. So really it kind of is, it depends on where you see this from. Is it part and parcel of ADHD? The answer is usually if it's not treated earlier. But if you treat or you identify and treat ADHD earlier, then it becomes less likely to develop. And I think the key here is the awareness. If a parent, say, for example, has no idea about something with called ADHD, and they come in, you know, that their child is an absolute nightmare, he doesn't listen to anyone, he's always in trouble, school are calling me every day. When you actually tell them that this actually, he doesn't have control over this, he's not making conscious decisions, they see it slightly differently. Even the change of attitude towards how they parent or how they tell a child off is different. So for example, you forgot this again. Okay. It can be then, oh, by the way, did you remember to do that thing? You know, there's a very different approach to both. You know, it's the same message, but how it's being delivered is very different. Then the impact on the child's development, self-esteem, worth, you know, very different approach. Mm-hmm.
Many people are asking about behaviors and consequences that should be applied for behaviors that are not desirable. What if my child doesn't follow instructions? What if they don't finish the task? What if they refuse to do schoolwork? So you a little bit answered that, saying first understand that this is not something frequently that they do out of bad will, that there is the brain development and the way the brain functions stops them from sometimes meeting our expectations. What else would you say to these parents? What should they do? How should they deal with this defined behaviors? Or behaviors about what they want?
It's a tricky one, if I'm being honest. There's two sides to the coin. I mean, if you really kind of see it as ADHD and we are looking at ADHD and the child really has difficulties doing a task, the first thing I'd ask myself is the task set be realistic for this child? So, you know, if he has a attention span of, say, half an hour, 20 minutes, at the most, and you're asking him to do homework that takes 40 minutes, it's not going to happen. Okay, so you need to kind of look at, is it something that is achievable? Okay, then if it isn't, then you need to change the approach. So for example, if it's a 20 minute or a 40 minute task, maybe break them into 10 minute tasks and work towards them with breaks in the middle so that you don't expend his attention and focus, and that he can, it can add longer, but it will be less of a war to achieve the task itself. The other side of the coin, I mean, there are other methods, and I don't think we can get into all of them, but that's just an example. But there is the other side of the coin where ADHD starts becoming an excuse. Okay, I can't do this because my ADHD, or I did this because it was my ADHD. I'm sorry, that's not an excuse. Patients, teenagers in particular, you know, ADHD will not get you out of being tried for a crime in a court because you know right from wrong. So it is not going to give you an innocent verdict. And the same applies to the very basic concept. You know, I can't do this because of my ADHD. No, you can. You're choosing not to do it is a different story. So I think we need to be understanding, but also aware that some children can actually just avoid doing things and blame the ADHD. It is not a disability. And actually, on the contrary, if you understand how the brain works, it's an extremely powerful thing, ADHD. Your brain is on 100 miles an hour. It just needs some breaks and some guidance. And if you understand the strengths of your brain and work around the weaknesses, you really can achieve a lot.
Mm. And in this context a little bit, this is something also that we had many questions about, is how would you advise parents to deal with school when it comes to ADHD?
I'm being absolutely 100% honest. Not all schools have the awareness. We're working with as many schools as we can, and we're slowly kind of trying to spread the awareness. And I think the ADEC and government are really, really putting in a lot of effort to have resources available for children with ADHD or any difficulties within the educational needs. I think key is communication with the school. Now, some parents worry about the school kind of child or wanting them out of the way because they don't have the resources or it's kind of too difficult. They don't want the child labeled, so they decide, no, we'll keep this a secret. The truth is, like anything else, schools, employers have a duty of care towards their students and employees. And disclosing these things to them should allow them that duty of care. So a school should allow certain accommodations for children with ADHD or give them certain methods of learning or change in the way homeworks are given. So someone with ADHD, you might be a bit more flexible at university with deadlines, you know, have more tutor time instead of once every 2-3 weeks, you'd make sure that you see them once a week to keep tabs on how they're going and break things down into, you know, smaller tasks. Procrastination, big time ADHD. So come to the project, the night of the project, you're trying to fill everything in and get it delivered. While if you had tabs with your tutor every week, he might kind of say, right, you deadlines, understanding a bit more.
I'll take a question from the chat and about adults for a change. Could you talk about the difference in adult women with ADHD in symptoms and treatment? Are there differences regarding gender and age, young adults, people over 40?
No, the answer is no. And it's the basic tenets of ADHD are the basic tenets. The only difference will be in context. So in someone who is a young adult, so for example, say in their 30s, it depends, you know, are they working? Are they a mother at home? And you have to take, you know, are they in a relationship? Are they single? All of these things have to be taken into context. And using the basic tenets of inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, and what challenges they pose, you have to look at the presentation from there. I will give you an example, and the same applies for people over 40. I'll give you a small example of age. I had... when I used to work privately in London, I had an ADHD service, and a lady who was 65 years old brought her husband in, 65, and said, "Hi, doctor, we're here because I think my husband has ADHD." And I thought, well, a bit late, don't you think? Can't you to recommend? And she said, "No, he's retired. And since he's retired, he's driving me crazy." Or what did you do? And he was a Formula One cameraman. Now, when you take that job and give someone who has ADHD that job, where you're constantly on the go, high powered, high paced, moving, you know, that is perfect for someone with ADHD. You won't even realize he has ADHD because it's perfectly paced. But now he's retired, sat at home, the context has changed. You'll get a lot of the symptoms coming out much more and you'll see it much more. So again, it's context driven as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I came back to a question that was asked at the beginning. What would be more practical to send students to universities or vocational training? It is high up. It was one of the first questions asked. More practical to send these students to universities or vocational training, speaking of the right fit of environment for people with ADHD?
It depends on, look, ADHD in itself, like I say, it is those three tenets. It really depends on his abilities. You know, is he a person who is a hands-on learner and he is not the best with books, for example? Maybe he's the best engineer or he works with motors better than anyone you've ever seen before, And he's not a book person. So you have to look at it. The ADHD itself is not a hamper to what you choose to do. It might be your abilities are what direct you. And I think that should be the direction with regards to university or if it's vocational. Look at your cognitive profile and suit your choices based on that, not the ADHD, because the ADHD in anything will cause the same problems, focus, attention, hyperactivity, impulsivity. So really the depends on your cognitive profile there. So can I just come back to the question by Anna about the gender differences?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. There is a difference with regards to gender presentation between male and female. But there isn't a difference in the sense of young and older adults. I think I'd be more than happy to share one of the papers that we published, a consensus paper about ADHD in females, maybe on one of the platforms. And that was published by UCAP a few years ago. And it's a detailed paper about ADHD in females.
I'm sure that will be very much appreciated, and I can pass it on if you email it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am getting suggestions to let people ask questions to you directly, as in being unmuted and do that. Are we okay with that, Dr. Imad and Ali? Are we okay to do that?
Yep. Let me just open up access. We can ask people to raise hands, and they can unmute themselves now.
If you'd like to ask a question to Dr. Imad directly, then please raise your hand on Zoom, or maybe put your camera on. Is that allowed if people don't know how to raise their hands virtually? Let's see. Okay, Mar, I can see your hand up. I guess I can unmute you, okay. Right. Okay, I think I'll mute you. You're on, Mar.
Yeah. Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, thank you so much for this conversation. I have a kid, 12 years old, my son. We diagnosed at the age of 7. He is not in the severe, he is mild, but my problem is he is not focusing on the studies.
Your question is?
My only problem is he is not focusing on the studies, particularly he is very, very low in the mathematics. He forgetting the things no matter how many times you teach them.
Okay.
Is that in? Yeah.
How is he doing in other
subjects? Other chapters, he is average. And if you go for music, he is doing very perfect without any training, without any practice, without without any instruction. He is playing piano like a master.
If I'm right in thinking, your question is why is it just the maths particularly, and he's not.
Yes, focused? Yes, because I just missed that. Nobody teach him music. Nobody teach him how to play the piano, but he's playing like a master. But simple things in the mathematics, he is forgetting the things. Even if you teach, if I teach him 10 times and if I ask him next day morning, he will forget the things.
Okay. My advice to you there, can I ask, has he diagnosed with ADHD?
Yes, yes.
Are you taking any medications at all?
At the age of 8, he took some medicine. It's called Inspiral 10 mg. Inspiral 10 mg. It was recommended in India. When you take treatment in India, the doctor prescribed a name called Inspiral. Inspiral 10 mg.
Okay, that might be the trade name, so it's not the
actual. It's the tablet name. The name of the tablet itself, Inspiral.
Okay.
During this, when he take this tablet, he was a bit focused in the classroom. This is what the feed I got from the class teacher. So after that, there was continuing complaints from the class teacher because he was not focused. It is typical with all ADHD kids. Now he is controllable in the classroom. Okay, he is not disturbing others. He is just focusing, but he cannot capture the the class. That is my point. He cannot concentrate. He cannot keep the things in the mind. But other things, if he watch a video for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, he remember all the things.
My advice to you would be that first of all, I would kind of have him assessed cognitively for a cognitive profile to get an understanding of his cognitive profile. It may well be that he has difficulties with numbers, something called dyscalculia, that needs to be taken into account. Numbers might not be his friend, and I can certainly put my hand up to that as a child. Me and numbers never mixed, and to this day they never mix with me either. It's just the way my makeup is. I would also, the fact that he is able musically, it might be that is his talent and that is his ability.
Yes.
Rather than actually, I would strongly recommend actually looking at a cognitive profile first, because it may be that he has specific learning difficulties in certain areas that might be his lack of focus, rather than it actually being ADHD, because that's something you have to look at. Because one of the criteria for ADHD diagnosis is cannot be better explained by something else. So if you have someone who has a specific learning difficulty or dyslexia, and you're putting them into literacy, not going to focus as well as someone who doesn't have dyslexia or learning fine. So you want to adjust for that first, and then if there are still problems, you could consider ADHD. You know, someone who is severely anxious, that may cause you not to focus. So you have to account for these things first and then adjust for them before reaching a diagnosis of ADHD. Now, another thing here is people who do not have ADHD, who take medication, may see an improvement of sort, but it is not as significant as you will see with someone with ADHD.
But he took that medicine only for 3 months, then he didn't continue, but after that, he is focused. He didn't make any complaints from the classroom.
Okay. I would recommend the psychometric testing and a cognitive profile as a first protocol.
Can you name again the name of the test?
It's a cognitive profile, so a psychometric.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir. Thanks for your listening.
Thank you. Dr. Mohammed Shaksad has got a question and is already unmuted conveniently. Hello.
I am Dr. Shahzad, and it was a very informative session, but unfortunately I joined late because I was also doing any one patient. I'm doing a static practice. My question is, my son is 12 years old and his weight is around 53 kg. And we knew about 6 years back that he had ADHD, and we have been going to qualified consultants, pediatric psychiatrists, and now we are giving him Concerta, which is methylphenidate, long-acting, 18 milligram, and risperidone, 1 milligram per day, 0.5 milligram in the morning and 0.5 milligram at night. My question is, on one side, we are giving him Concerta, which is a stimulant drug. On the other side, he is advised to give risperidone at the same time. Risperidone, what I know, is a slowing drug. So they will not counteract with each other.
Okay. Why is risperidone being prescribed is my question.
Because of his hyperactivity. Because we have tried 3 schools in UAE since 2019. Two schools, and because of his hyperactivity, and he was not able to sit in the class more than 10-15 minutes, and he tried to go out of the class by some reason. I want to go to washroom, I have some headache, I have fever, I am feeling pain, going to dispensary, and all the time the teachers, they were bothered by his hyperactivity. And we also have tried, one of the consultants, they also tried the other drug, which is non-stimulant, but it started side effects like suicidal ideation. We gave it for 6 weeks, the drug name was, which is other than methylphenidate, Statira.
Yes.
Statira.
Okay. So your question is, how can we give a stimulant and something that kind of calms down as well?
Yeah, at the same time.
Okay. Maybe you missed the part earlier on when I was talking about stimulants. A stimulant is not to stimulate someone to be more active. A stimulant is to stimulate the release of dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, where it is needed for focus, attention, and hyperactivity. So they don't actually counteract each other, both of these. Mm-hmm. Risperidone is a third line treatment for ADHD. So it wouldn't be the first line. I would rather look at adjusting the dose of Concerta, or maybe topping up with a Ritalin to give that bioavailability. Because if the Concerta is, if he's taking 18 milligrams and he's at the moment 53 kg, the concentration per kilogram would be quite low. And I don't think it would be doing much, if I'm being honest. But I would probably adjust the Concerta to a higher concentration per kilogram. And the problem with risperidone is, it's an antipsychotic medication and it's primarily given to reduce aggression and outbursts, but also there's side effects such as increased appetite and increased weight over time is something to really take into consideration as well.
Actually, I'm taking more time. Actually, 8 months back, we stopped this risperidone only because he was gaining weight and the other drug was added by one of the consultants. But after 40 days, there was no effect and his aggression was increased. He was talking about suicidal ideation developed in him. So the consultant stopped that drug and again risperidone was added.
Okay. I wouldn't generally mix stimulant and non-stimulant medication. So I would probably think, again, I can't speak for any other colleague. In my opinion, I would have probably considered increasing the Concerta or maybe spreading it over the day a bit more. Generally speaking, you make one change at a time to be able to measure what you're actually doing and the effects.
And actually, as you talked about Ritalin, we started with Ritalin, but at that time we were in our country, Pakistan, and there was Concerta was not available. We started with Ritalin 10 milligram. At the time, his weight was only 25, 30. But with Ritalin, he was complaining of frequent headache. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when we started this Concerta, he's not complaining any headache. Maybe at that time when we started, his weight was more than 45 kg and it is low dose for him. This is the reason that he's not complaining of any headache.
Possibly, very much so.
And the same issue we are facing that he does not want to sit for study. He does not want to sit for study. He has a lot of ideas. He wants to become a billionaire, but doing nothing.
Again, I would say to you or to parents generally, the way doesn't have to be in a particular manner. We are used to learning being sat at a desk, at a table, opening a book. I would say if this child learns while walking around, or doing it in chunks of 10 minutes and he achieves what he needs to achieve, then it's a win-win situation. There are no particular rules, maybe in the school, yes, but if he needs to achieve that, then if it works for him, then I think we need to let that work for him. So for example, there was a question earlier on I saw about what do we do about the restlessness? Well, sometimes you need to endorse it. So, if a child is quite restless in the classroom and, medication is only doing so much, maybe I can use that child in a very positive manner. So, get him to get up and, wipe the board or distribute the papers and collect the papers or take this over there or do that, something more positively engaging rather than being critical about it. You might get more out of the child in the shorter and longer term.
Thank you very much. We are also taking help of the behavior, the educational therapist. Mm-hmm. And we are also giving medication. But as you told that we should revise the regime, like Concerta and Risperidone, we will try to connect with some you or other consultant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, I am very conscious of time, Dr. Imad, and you are with us after a full days of work. Are you happy to take one more question from Anna?
One more, then I've got to run off to my little boy who is stuck into bed.
Okay, Anna, go ahead. I'm going to try my best to unmute you right now.
I would like to say hello from London, UK.
Hello.
And my question is about comorbidities. You mentioned about autism, and I know I'm aware that there is a quite large number of same symptoms between ADHD and autism. I mean, at least people sharing that. So there is one thing about the question about diagnosing and then treating, you know, like separating or being aware how much is in common, how much is separate. But I would like to add to this the other thing, PTSD trauma, because there's also the result of trauma during the especially early childhood on adult psyche and behavior. So I wonder if you can just share your thoughts about, from one hand, diagnosing and being aware of comorbidities, and then also treating and being aware of comorbidities.
Okay, so let's start with the comorbidities part. So the rule, and not the exception, is that there is going to be a comorbidity with ADHD. That has to be the rule. So you're looking at 90-95% comorbidities with ADHD, be it affective disorders, be it sleep disturbances, be it depression, be it neurodevelopmental difficulty like learning difficulty or autism. Now, of course, it may be, you know, is it the chicken or the egg with regards to trauma? Because a lot of children with ADHD put themselves in situations that may be quite traumatic. And it may be as a result of impulsive behaviors or otherwise. It may be a result simply of the, you know, circumstances and has nothing to do with the fact that they have ADHD. But yes, the rule is that there is comorbidity. Now, when you're asking, do you treat one or the other first? Well, I would probably think of treating the one that is likely to respond the quickest, and that's probably the ADHD. Because the response to medication is much, much quicker and seen so much quicker within days that you can actually then gauge what has improved from an ADHD perspective and what is left with regards to otherwise. So, for example, if we're looking at the comorbidity between autism and ADHD, it's quite significant. So if you treat, if you're quite confident that this is a comorbidity and ADHD exists in this context of autism, then I would treat the ADHD immediately, because the likelihood is that you may see a reduction in the symptoms of ADHD and hence a reduction in the presentation of the severity of the autism. And what you're left with is more in the context of the spectrum. Again, you're treating anxiety or depression. Again, if you treat the ADHD first, you see what is left for you to treat, but always keeping in mind that comorbidity is the rule, not the exception with ADHD.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I think we're done. I have done my best to answer, to read out all the questions that I could see. My apologies if I missed yours. Anybody that is present here? Thank you so much, Dr. Imad, for your time and for your expertise.
I'm sorry if we didn't get around to answering all of the questions.
I think we missed some perhaps, but you know, time is always limited, unfortunately. Thank you again for being with us tonight. I hope everybody's leaving. I know everybody's leaving very, very well informed. And yes, everybody have a good night.
Thank you.